Richie Allen tonight.
Welcome back. Before we get to our next guest, John sent us an email. Thanks, John. He said, Richie, I never thought I'd see the day when people would be waging war on areas like Pakistan from the sky remotely, as you described there. Thanks for that, John. You can find that article, by the way, on guardian.co.uk. Pratap Chatterjee wrote it last Wednesday. Incredible stuff that, so it is. Let's introduce our next guest. Welcoming back to the programme. He spoke with us about 10 or 12 days back. The weekend before last, the Bilderberg meeting took place in Switzerland. We said we'd do a follow-up on that. He's a former BBC journalist. He's written for over 12 years extensively on Bilderberg, what it is, what goes on there, and very, very interesting things on his website. We'll talk about that in a minute. Let's welcome back Tony Gosling. Tony, welcome back. How are you?
Hi. Yes, thanks for having me on again.
Very brave
of you.
Oh, well, it's not so brave. I tend to live in a hovel. Nobody knows where I am, you see. But no, it's serious stuff. Tony, you sent me an email. You've got some information for us. The Bilderberg meeting took place. What do we think, or what do we know was talked about at it? And if you want to give us a flavour of who was at the Bilderberg meeting the weekend before last.
Well, first of all, I mean, the usual sort of bunch of people are there. This is, just for those of you, your listeners, that haven't heard about the Bilderberg as much, it's royalty. That is to say, certainly the heads of royalty in Belgium, Spain, Norway, in fact, all countries in Europe that have royalty, send them there. We had our royalty go in past years, but they weren't on the official list this year. And then there's the bankers. I mean, these are the sort of devils of the moment, you know, with regards to the financial crisis, the people who like to sort of occasionally crawl out from under stone. You certainly don't see them much on programs like Newsnight. You know, what we're left to do is to have economic correspondents talking about what's going on, because these financial institutions are scared to death of putting their bankers up front in front of the public to explain their... well, let's be kind to them and call them mistakes. So we're talking not just about ordinary sort of banks like Santander or Barclays. We're talking about the IMF, the World Bank, Bank for International Settlements. These are the big financial institutions that govern the world's financial system. And also the Federal Reserve, the bank of the dollar, and the euro. They're saying the European Central Bank. So they're there, as well as the chief executive of all the major companies, particularly oil companies, in the Western world. Now, this is a kind of okay for all this lot, I imagine, to get together, because that's what business people do. But the problem is that you've got in there as well, you've got elected finance ministers. You know, you've got people like George Osborne, who is there this year with his Treasury team, you know, paid for by the taxpayer, and yet we're not allowed to know anything about what George Osborne has negotiated with these people while he was in there. And it's not just from the UK. You've got finance ministers from places like Spain, Greece, all these places we keep hearing about that have got to have bailouts, and these kind of people. So there's a pretty toxic mix. And the problem of it all is that the politicians that go there are volunteering to go. That is to say that they are more interested in rubbing shoulders with the rich and powerful than they are in the people that elect them. And they will sworn to secrecy. They will tell us nothing about what they discussed inside whatsoever, and that's part of the deal. They are more interested in their own egos, really, and schmoozing with the rich and powerful.
You painted a great picture of it last time you were on, and I remember the way you put it was that these politicians, these young men and women of politics, of the political future, are basically on parade there in front of the financiers, the people with all of the money, basically.
Well, that's there's that as well, right? That's an addition to what we've just been talking about, because I've been saying these are the people who are in real power. Royalty have real power, particularly with regard to armed forces, etc. And they also do a lot of appointments, this kind of thing, to key positions. And the chief executives of the oil companies and the media companies that are there, they have real power right now, as do the finance ministers. But Bilderberg also is a kind of a horse fair for up-and-coming politicians, so that these big bankers from the Western world, NATO countries, can have a good old look at these up-and-coming politicians and say, well, this one, we like the look of this one, we like the shape of this one. And this is why it's so pernicious. And I must say, this year, I think there's been some of the best best coverage I've ever seen.
It's got massive coverage, Tony,
By Charlie Skelton at The Guardian. He's built a blog, and if your listeners are interested in looking that up, it's if you look for Swiss Family Rockefeller,
that's what he's called it.
And David Rockefeller, of course, is a US oil magnate and banker who's one of the key people involved in all this. I mean, you know, I would describe them as a kind of NATO zone mafia. This, that is to say, people who are so rich that they have, they've had all of the luxury yachts, all of the mansions, all of the businesses they want that they've bought up, have ordered all of the prostitutes they could ever wish for. And now what do you then do when you've got more and more money and you're absolutely obsessed, you have a love of money and greed, is that you, what you then want to do is to start to buy up the media and buy up the political process. And that's what this lot are up to, I'm afraid. You know, we like to think we're living in the Europe, a free Europe, but fortunately, it's not as free as we think, because a lot of these people pull the strings and they seem to be aggrandizing more and more about most important companies. I mean, obviously, they can't actually buy parliaments, but what they can do is they can have a tremendous amount of influence over our political parties, and that's what they've been doing here in Britain.
Doing, you know,
Tony Blair, for example, the leader of the Labour Party, he was chosen at the Bilderberg Conference in 1992. He was introduced to the world's leaders. They liked him. In 1993, he got the nomination to become Labour leader after John Smith, who the Bilderbergers didn't like, who was a Labour leader before that. And then his meteoric rise to power commenced. And that's what, you know, they're the kind of kingmakers in the political sphere. That's what these Bilderbergers are.
You know, Tony, I've interviewed Michael Meacher on this programme, and he said that all of the, I suppose, the likes of him and Tony Benn and people like that, they could not believe what Blair and Brown began to do only minutes into their time at number 10. They thought it was, because it was such a, you remember the majority they won with? They won with a landslide majority, the Labour Party in 97. And because of that, Michael Meacher said to me, we thought we had the go-ahead, the blueprint, to really make some really effective, brilliant social change that Labour had been talking about for years, with, through John Smith, through Kinnock and people like that. And everything he did, we know now ultimately, was to, I suppose, to pay back the people who put him in the position in the first place, to serve the corporate masters. It was never the left-wing Labour Party that 13 years they had in government.
Well, I don't think Tony Blair was ever a left-wing person in reality. I mean, he actually was part of a lot of left movements in CND and these kind of things in Britain, a campaign for nuclear disarmament, and other kind of left-wing pressure groups and bodies. Now, there is a suspicion, and this is only a suspicion, that actually Tony Blair was at that time an informant for MI5, the Internal Security Service.
Heard they said before, yeah.
And he was, this is according to David Shaler, who was himself an ex-MI5 officer. Now, when Shaler was arrested, I mean, he basically was a whistleblower. And the few days after he was very first in the Mail on Sunday, then Tony Blair actually called the editor of the Mail on Sunday to Downing Street and said, went out into the garden where he was hoping there were no microphones listening to him. And he said, what does Shaler know? That was I can't remember the name of the editor at the time, but that's an absolutely, I mean, I've heard that from the horse's mouth, both from Annie Machon and from Shaler himself, that this is what happened. And so it does look rather like Tony Blair was extremely worried that maybe somebody at MI5 might have blown his cover. Now, it sounds bizarre, doesn't it, that someone who was actually an informant for MI5 might make it to be Prime Minister. But, I mean, that seems to be the case with Blair. And I think the other thing is, I'm really disgusted to see that he still hasn't been arranged for war crimes, having seen the prima facie evidence of him helping to sex up this dossier.
That's
with
right.
And we've got now what we call the Downing Street Memo, which is prima facie evidence of war crimes, trying to actually fit the invasion of Iraq around, fit the evidence around the policy being invade Iraq, and then just go around and see if you can drum up any old evidence to justify it. That's what was going on, and that's what the Downing Street Memo says. So there is prima facie evidence for a war crimes trial against Tony Blair and those that collaborated with
him. Well, don't forget, Tony, the Chilcot Inquiry have all but stopped short of calling him a liar. They called him back a second time round. General Sir Michael, what was the guy's name? He basically called Andrew... Mine's gone blank.
You're talking about General Sir Michael Rose?
Yes, that's the one, who called, basically called him a liar, said the evidence he'd given was unsound.
I mean, I think that, you know, most of your listeners will be familiar with a lot of this stuff, and I think the thing is, try and take a step back from all this murky, nasty business, and let's try and think, well, what is going on here? And it does seem that we're living in a world where partly the internet has been responsible for this, but it's like that the scales have fallen from our eyes, and we can see that a lot of our leaders are actually irresponsible. Yeah. You know, there are people who are in those positions because they want to use them for their own gain.
Tony, stand by. Hang on a second. Steve is on the line. I think he wants in on this. It's there, Steve. Steve, how are you?
I'm very good, thank you. I was just listening to your guest here. Is it Tony?
It's Tony, yeah. Go ahead, Tony.
Listen, Tony, you should perhaps check out Giovanni Di Stefano's website, because he walked into a police station in Kent on Friday and lodged a complaint against Tony Blair for breaches against the Geneva Convention. He's got a crime reference number. It was reported to the UK media. It wasn't picked up by the UK media for reasons to themselves, but it was reported in the French and Italian and German media.
I would say,
and here, of course,
say to your friend who's done that, absolutely fantastic, and pat on the back to him. But I would also not give up with the press. I mean, you know, I think you have to be very consistent. Don't think that the media are actually going to do any kind of investigating. They need to have everything given to them on a plate.
No, I know. Listen, I know that.
We've got that, for example, just today here in Bristol. We've got a front page lead story on the Bristol Evening Post, which is talking about, was 9/11 some kind of inside job? You know, this is the culmination of a lot of effort where you have to actually really try. I mean, having worked in journalism myself, I know that journalists are very overworked, editors are very overworked, they get phoned up by lots of cranks. The thing to do is to build up a relationship with journalists and with editors, and of course you're going to get double-crossed sometimes, but, you know, don't give up, is all I'd say. And, I'm really pleased to see that we've got the front page lead today now questioning the official story of 9/11 all across the city of Bristol.
Well, that's incredible,
that's
isn't it?
That's a huge breakthrough. But I don't have it to hand, I think Richie should be able to give you Giovanni's website, because
it's fine, I can check it out later, don't worry, that's no problem. But all I'm saying is, you know, he may be dismayed having had a go at getting this stuff in the press, but all I'm saying is, don't give up, never give up, because if you know something's true, eventually someone will pick up on it.
Brilliant stuff. Steve has just rung off there. Thanks for that, Steve. Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I was coming to the Giovanni thing anyway. He's a well-known lawyer. He defended some of the... he defended Saddam Hussein, incidentally, and he's currently acting as a lawyer for Charles Manson. You might find that bizarre, but he is, amongst other things. And he's been on Blair's case for a couple of years, and he's trying to get Blair, as Steve said there, indicted for war crimes. Let's go back to Bilderberg. What have we heard about what happened during the meeting in Zurich? Have we heard anything at all, Tony?
Well, only a little bit in the way of leaks. You know, I think some of the most fantastic footage, and I don't know if you've seen the film on the internet of the nature walk that Peter Mandelson took with a whole bunch of the Bilderbergers. You know, I think that this really does show, doesn't it, the psychology of the Bilderbergers. They really think that they can just book a hotel with the most rich and powerful people in the NATO zone, and they don't have to tell anybody about it, and then they can just go for a little walk up the hillside with no problems. Now, as it happens, all of the protesters were very well-behaved, pretty much, and peaceful, and just simply filming them and politely asking them questions. But what they were doing there was really showing to me that they are actually in this kind of illusion that there won't be any scrutiny of them. I think one of the things that Charlie's done with his Swiss Family Rockefeller blog and all the other work he's been doing is to galvanise a lot of opinion around the world, saying, well, hang on a minute, you know, if you're not going to report on this, media, then I'm actually going to drive over to where the Bilderbergers are meeting, or get on a plane, and I'm going to do your job for you, because this is a fantastic attitude. Of course, it's like, this is not my job syndrome is out of the window. You know, it's like saying, well, you know, I don't want to do this, it's someone else's job to do it. Actually, what people are saying is not saying that anymore. They're saying, well, if the mainstream media is not going to do this, I'm going to, even if it means you just go to the Bilderberg conference to sit around in the bar and chat with some of the journalists, some of the researchers and campaigners that are down there, then what you're doing is you're bearing witness to this crime.
It is a crime, and when we spoke about it last time, it's been said to me before on this programme and in the past on other programmes that I've been involved with and presented, that there's a real there's a treachery, there's a treasonous treachery, whatever you want to call it, angle to this. Any politician who's elected turning up, you know.
To actually get to the question you were asking about leaks, I haven't heard anything this year of actually what the content was at the conference at all, which is strange. Normally, the hotel staff talk because a lot of them are not happy with what some of them see as fascists or even, you know, sort of the modern-day version of the Nazis meeting up in their hotel. A lot of the hotel staff often are prepared to talk to journalists after the event, that sort of thing. So I haven't seen anything of that this time. Maybe it's just simply that they're far too scared to. You know, it's difficult to know exactly then what they were talking about in there. Clearly the Euro, clearly the Arab Spring, but it's just a question of what else, you know, was being discussed and what points were being made by our Chancellor, who's being paid to be in there with his Treasury team. It's all secret.
Tony, it's a surprise to me that the staff at any of these hotels wouldn't be forced or asked, forced into signing a disclaimer, signing a piece of paper to say they'll never reveal anything that they hear during the 3 days or the 4 days of the conference.
I think there's a kind of veiled threat as well to the participants. I had a chat, this is back in 2003, with the Greek finance minister, and he was, you know, he's a pretty senior guy in Greece, and even he was saying, well, you know, I actually really don't like the atmosphere in there. It's nice to get out, and, you know, the price of cigarettes is really expensive, and it's lovely to actually come and have a chat with you guys, because, you know, you are where it's at. So let's not get this wrong. I think what's happening in those meetings is that this is a immense amount of pressure being put on our politicians, who actually, most of whom actually want to represent us. It's like holding a gun to their head. This is what these the financial people, the royalty, and the big business people in there are doing, and they're holding a gun to their head and saying, "Look, you're going to play the game our way, or there'll be trouble." In fact, they've even been saying this today in Greece, haven't they? I don't know if you've heard this.
They're saying, I have. I've been following it today.
You're going to do the bailout, or else. Essentially, that's what they're saying to them. You know, this is actually mafia tactics, and I just do hope that the Greek government and the Greek people have nothing of it and stand up to them.
Peter has been on, he sent us an email saying, look, hang on a minute, this might be treachery or a betrayal of trust by the attending politician, but what evidence does Tony have that any crime has taken place?
Sorry, say that again. Sorry,
yeah, Peter has said that there may be treachery or a betrayal of trust going on there in terms of politicians attending. But what evidence does Tony have that a crime has taken place?
Well, I would call it criminal because the Logan Act in the United States states that no elected politician is allowed to go to a private unminuted meeting because that's cast as betraying the public. In fact, it is actually a criminal offence in the United States. I mean, there are questions over other countries in Europe over whether it is. You just go to your favourite search engine, not necessarily Google, who were there, by the way, Eric Schmidt, and make sure that you check out the Logan Act, because that shows you exactly why this is a crime. I mean, you don't need to be a genius to work out that we don't really want our elected politicians going and swearing to secrecy in one of the most important meetings of the most powerful, richest people in the NATO countries. Now, the other aspect to all this, of course, is it's Freemasonry. I mean, there's a couple of very powerful connections to Freemasonry. One is the Joseph Rechinger, the guy that actually got the Bilderberg meetings started. I mean, he wasn't the first chairman, but he was the guy behind the scenes that was working for 3 years. This is in 1950, 51, 52, 53. To actually get the very first meeting going in 1954. Rechinger was a former MI6 officer. He was also a Freemason. In fact, he was Polish, and if anyone is good at reading the Polish language, which I'm afraid I'm not, the Polish are actually publishing quite a lot of books on him, because it's being realised in Poland that Rechinger was a very powerful and important and influential figure. He was also implicated, in fact, in the death of General Sikorsky, who was the Polish leader in exile in the Second World War, and Sikorsky was his personal aide, also working for MI6 at the time. So Sikorsky's, he was a very, very... What happened at the end of the Second World War is Poland was basically sold out, sold off to the Soviet Union, much to the chagrin of Sikorsky, and Sikorsky started kicking up a fuss, and then he had an accident and died. Now, that was one of the very first trips that Sikorsky had ever taken that Joseph Rettinger wasn't on the plane next to him. He'd actually remained behind in Gibraltar when Sikorsky died. So there are a lot of questions about this character being a bit of a sort of éminence grise, and he also is well known in Poland and in, you know, in all the literature that he was a Freemason. The other thing is that the last meeting that took place in Britain, which is Turnberry, Bilderberg, in 1998, June or May, whatever, roughly at that time of the year, was organised by a guy called Andrew Palmer. Now, Andrew Palmer has on his CV that he is the private assistant of the Duke of Kent, who is the Grand Master of World Freemasonry. So you can see that it's not just, you know, some sort of silly bit of speculation to say that there is a connection with Freemasonry. You know, and this I find really rather worrying, because, you know, there's a whole network of secrecy connected with ideas to do with Freemasonry. A lot of things to do with police corruption, for example, have been linked to Freemasonry. If you have a look at the book The Brotherhood by Stephen Knight, you'll see, you know, quite a lot of serious problems in the 1960s, 70s and 80s have been traced to Masonic networks within the police. And we just had an article in The Guardian a couple of weeks ago by Nick Davis showing that this phone hacking scandal is also linked to Masonic lodges which are within the police. I mean, that is, you know, astounding to say it, but check that out on the Guardian.
Yeah, I saw that article by Davis. Yeah, I mean, if that's true, if there are Masonic lodges within the police force, that is a worrying development.
So no, I mean, that's a fact. There definitely are. I mean, some police, some lodges are just police lodges. And all of the background on this, you can look up through Stephen Knight's book, The Brotherhood, and also there was Martin Short wrote a sequel to it after Stephen died called Inside the Brotherhood, which has got a lot of evidence of this kind of thing, very, very clear. And you know, this is talking to ex-Freemasons as well. But the reason I mentioned Freemasonry is because I think that a lot of the problems of the world really... You can look at them in this kind of Tolkien-esque perspective. And the reason I talk about Tolkien, which you may think that's an amazing leap of imagination, Tony, the symbolism used in the Tolkien novels, The Lord of the Rings, what is it, The Twin Towers, The Return of the King, is actually, I think, based around Masonic symbolism. And there are basically the White Hand of Saruman, who's one of the characters in The Lord of the Rings. That's the Freemasons, in my view. You've got the White Hand, because all the Freemasons wear white gloves. And then you've got the Dark Ones, the people who are Freemasons. They're, you know, good and charitable, but they've actually sold their souls to the devil. That's the Illuminati. That is the eye symbol. And that eye symbol is in The Lord of the Rings on the Sauron, the Dark Lords. Orcs all use that symbol. So I think actually Tolkien was being very, very subtle in getting that across in symbolism in his novels.
Tony, stand by. John, you're live. Good evening.
Yeah, just out of curiosity, some years ago in England, my neighbour, he and I had children around the same age. He was a solicitor. He invited me to join the Masonic Lodge that he belonged to. And, of course, out of curiosity, I joined. I didn't stay long enough to get into the chair, as it were. It's a lot of ritual to start off with. Anyway, interestingly enough, that lodge was full of solicitors and police. Okay.
Wow.
You can take that from me.
Thanks, John. Good
and
to hear from you on that. Thanks, John. There you have it, yeah.
It's over our whole criminal justice system, isn't it? Because, you know, we need to know, I think it's absolutely clear, the law says that if you have any interest, that is to say, if as a Freemason is taking part in a court case, the judge or a solicitor has to actually stand aside, the same way as you would have to you have to declare that interest and stand aside, same as if you were a director of a company. You'd have to stand aside from a decision and declare an interest. But this is why they want the Masonic lists and lodges to be kept secret, so they don't have to do that.
Tony, we're out of time, I'm afraid. It was good to have you back on again. Thanks. Right, give us your website address again for those people to log on to it and read more about it.
Well, if you want to listen to our radio shows, that's thisweek.org.uk. That's thisweek.org.uk. And my main website about the Bilderbergers with all the history and everything, and I've got some more stuff going up on there tomorrow, is www.bilderberg.org. That's bilderberg.org.
Tony, thanks for
that. The main name was bought for me by one of Henry Kissinger's sister of one of Henry Kissinger's goddaughters.
Go on. And of course, he's been to nearly, well, probably all of the Bilderberg meetings, or at least nearly all of them anyway. Tony, thanks for coming on again. Great to hear from you. Thanks a lot. Take care. Bye-bye. That was Tony Gosling there. Tony's a former BBC journalist and works for Radio Bristol. The website's bilderberg.org and thisweek.org.uk. You can find a webcast and that of Tony's programmes. We'll be back. On Talk Radio Europe.